This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Back to square one. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka on this Monday, January 21st. Thanks for being with us, and here's what we have for you this hour.
President Trump made an offer over the weekend designed to end the government shutdown, but Democrats have rejected it.
Lingering travel delay is expected today as a good portion of the nation recovers from a massive winter storm that brought snow, ice, and a deep freeze.
For the ninth time in the last 18 seasons, the New England Patriots will play in the Super Bowl. They'll face the Los Angeles Rams on February 3rd.
And the number one job that super rich people say they had before they made it big, salesperson.
Everyone I talked to thought, well, yes, because sales impact everything. You start your own company, you're selling to everybody all the time, and especially with these people way high up. Maybe they had to get investors early on, stuff like that. But in all the cases, they said sales was a huge, huge reason that they feel financially successful right now.
Katie Hill at MarketWatch on millionaires and billionaires pointing to a sales job as a key to their success. She's here in about 20 minutes. President Trump is criticizing congressional Democrats for rejecting his latest proposal to reach an agreement on funding for his proposed border wall and end the partial government shutdown. As part of his suggestion, he would grant 3 years of protection from deportation for illegals who were brought into the U.S. as children, often referred to as dreamers.
3 years of legislative relief for 700,000 DACA recipients brought here unlawfully by their parents at a young age many years ago.
This group had been covered under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, and for people granted temporary protected status because of a crisis in their home countries. Democrats, like Texas Congresswoman Veronica Escobar, declared the offer a non-starter.
Extending protections for DACA student, DACA kids, and TPS, he eliminated those protections. So he's saying, let me fix the problem I caused, but give me $5.7 billion for a wall.
Yesterday, Mr. Trump accused Democrats of ignoring the drug trafficking and crime that he believes a border barrier would stop. A major winter storm brought some of the coldest temperatures of the season and blanketed a large portion of the country with snow, making travel by planes, trains, and automobiles very difficult in some areas. The National Weather Service issued winter storm warnings or advisories for part or all of at least 15 states, stretching from southeast Missouri to the northern tip of Maine ahead of the weekend storm. Brian Hurley is a meteorologist with the Weather Prediction Center.
Wind advisories out or in effect because of the wind behind the system, and also wind chill advisories. As we look for the wind chills, they'll be around 10 below zero, maybe a little colder.
Amtrak says it expects to have all of its trains back on a full schedule today. New York City and the metro region have escaped any significant snowfall, with the precipitation coming down mostly as rain. Meteorologists were concerned about the upcoming severe cold from last night into today, with expected wind chills in the teens in the New York City area, even down to well below zero around Albany, which got about a foot of snow. Our Super Bowl is set after the LA Rams rallied to beat the New Orleans Saints 26-23 in the NFC Championship. The New England Patriots outdueled the Kansas City Chiefs 37-31 in the AFC title. In the first game, the Rams fell behind 13-0 before Greg Zuerlein's 57-yard field goal in overtime cemented the comeback, but a no-call on a pass interference penalty did not allow the Saints to try a game-winning field goal as time would have expired in regulation. Saints coach Sean Payton.
Frustrating, you know, just getting off the phone with the league office. They blew the call, and man, there are a lot of opportunities, though, but that call puts in first and 10, we're on an E3 plays, and it's a game-changing call.
Meanwhile, with the Pats win, quarterback Tom Brady and head coach Bill Belichick will be aiming for New England's sixth Super Bowl title when they meet the Rams in 2 weeks. Rams coach Sean McVay, by the way, was 16 years old and quarterback Jared Goff was 8 when Brady and Belichick celebrated their first Super Bowl title. It's 11 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for spending time with us. Reminder, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. You can follow me on Twitter directly at Gordon Deal. The federal courts are running out of money as the partial government shutdown continues with no end in sight. Today is day 31. Tom Kaplan, Washington correspondent at the New York Times, says that's raising concerns that the legal system will be significantly hobbled if the standoff is not resolved soon. Tom, explain.
Well, the courts have been somewhat spared from the shutdown so far. They've been able to rely on money they've had available to stay afloat the past couple weeks. But time is running out, and within probably the next 2 weeks, the federal court system looks like it will run out of money, and then things will get much worse in courthouses around the country.
All right, meaning what? What could happen?
Well, it's a range of possibilities. So some cases have already been postponed, civil cases, even more may be postponed. Some employees are likely to be furloughed. Other employees who are still coming to work won't be paid anymore, with the exception of federal Supreme Court justices, appellate court judges, district court judges. And it will really just sort of grind courts to a halt, or at least disrupt sort of their orderly functioning, which is so important to individuals, businesses that come before courts. All sorts of things could happen.
Will there be efforts to preserve any remaining funds that they have, like close 2 days a week, or we took a look at a full closure of the court system at some point?
So what they've been doing the past couple weeks is to try to reduce expenses as much as possible to stretch their remaining funds as long as they can. And that's why they've been able to stay afloat and keep somewhat normal operations the past couple weeks. They have cut down on travel. They've cut down on new hiring, things like that, in order to make the money last as long as it can. But once they reach the point that the money has run out, then the courts will have to respond much in the way that executive branch agencies had to respond in December when the shutdown began. They'll have to kind of pare down their operations to mission-critical work. And there are lots of different ways this could happen. It's going to be decided on a court-by-court basis what steps will be taken. So one possibility, I was talking to an official at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers much of the West. One idea they're talking about is closing their courthouses one weekday per week and furloughing employees that weekday when the courthouses are closed. But there are lots of different ways that different courts could do it.
We're speaking with Tom Kaplan, Washington correspondent at the New York Times, about his piece about federal courts now running out of money and what that could mean in terms of the shutdown. I think there was one court you pointed out, too, like they're not going to host, for lack of a better term, extracurricular events like meetings or things like that.
Exactly, yeah. The Federal District Court in Brooklyn, they are telling groups that normally will have bar association meetings, continuing legal education, things like that, using courthouse facilities, that they need to find another place to do that. And sort of all different kinds of things that are not at the core of what courts do, which they view as resolving cases, other things will be put on hold as long as this goes on.
I suppose this means we're staring at a backlog, perhaps?
Well, that's the thing. It just makes sort of a difficult situation worse. There are, particularly at the district courts, a pretty significant number of vacancies in terms of judgeships around the country. So you have some courts that are already stretched quite thin. And as you know, I was told as I reported the story, it's not as if cases stop. It's not as if people are going to stop filing lawsuits. People will stop being arrested. That continues, so it just will pile up. And in the case of, you know, workers who are furloughed or courthouses that, you know, may close periodically, it's just going to be more work to dig out from when this ends, whenever that may be.
I didn't even think about kind of these smaller details like providing lunch for jurors.
Yeah, it's something that court officials are having to think about, just all the little things that courts have to pay for. What do you do if you can no longer if you don't have money to spend. That's a concern for federal court in Manhattan, which is a really busy court, just trying to figure out how do you buy lunch as jurors deliberate. They also have a concern there about if building workers, sort of the facilities workers, how long they will be paid for, and then what happens if you can't have building workers to keep the courthouse open, what do you do then? So it's all sorts of ripple effects that come from this that court officials are having to grapple with now.
Thanks, Tom. Tom Kaplan, Washington correspondent at the New York Times. It is 20 minutes now after the hour on this morning. Jennifer Koshenka is here with more of America's First News.
More than 31 days into the partial government shutdown, Democrats and Republicans appear no closer to ending the impasse than when it began, with President Trump lashing out at his opponents after they dismissed a plan he billed as a compromise. Trump yesterday branded House Speaker Nancy Pelosi a radical and said she was acting irrationally. Trump on Saturday offered to temporarily extend protections for young immigrants brought to the country illegally as children and those fleeing disaster zones in exchange for $5.7 billion for his border wall.
This is not a 2,000-mile concrete structure from sea to sea. These are steel barriers in high-priority locations.
Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York told ABC Trump needs to open the government, then they'll talk.
His idea for a wall is ineffective, and it's not going to make us safer. I will support border security. I will support investments to make our country strong and safe.
Nearly 800,000 federal workers are affected by the partial government shutdown. Bitter cold is setting in after a major winter storm blanketed a wide swath of the country in snow, sleet, and rain this weekend, creating dangerously icy conditions that promise to complicate cleanup efforts and make travel challenging. Some of the coldest temperatures felt so far this season started to set in across the Midwest and Northeast yesterday and plunged further overnight. Wind chills are bringing temperatures well below zero in parts of New York and New England. It was an historic day in the NFL with both playoff games going into overtime. In the first game, Greg Zuerlein of the Rams hit a 57-yard field goal in OT to upend the home team Saints 26-23. Rams coach Sean McVay.
Just so happy for these players, for these coaches, but a lot of respect for the Saints. And you know, we're excited about getting a chance to move on and play in Atlanta. Wow.
In the nightcap, the Patriots beat the Chiefs 37-31 to reach the Super Bowl for a third straight year. Rex Burkhead ran it in from 2 yards out to set up a meeting with the Rams. The Super Bowl will be held in Atlanta on February 3rd.
If I was a betting man,
you just lost it all.
I would have went 0-2 yesterday. I didn't know, boy. For the young quarterback like Goff to win on the road in New Orleans, that was impressive.
Pretty good games for a change.
Yeah, exciting weekend. Thank you, Jen. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Thanks for being with us. Welcome into Monday. There are billions of reasons to do this job. Many of today's self-made billionaires and multimillionaires held a sales job or sales jobs when they were younger. Here's Katie Hill, editor at MarketWatch, who looked at a new study. Katie, what are we learning?
So this researcher, Zeidelman, interviewed 45 very, very rich people. The minimum they were worth was about $11 million, and some of them were billionaires. And the number one job they had before they became, by the way, this is self-made billionaires and multimillionaires, was a sales job. So almost all of them in this study had some kind of sales job when they were younger. And it was interesting, by the way. It was everything from someone sold costume jewelry, another sold cosmetics. Somebody sold old egg cartons that were used as noise insulation. So these very, very, very rich people, almost all of them had sales jobs, a variety of different kinds of sales jobs. And the other thing that's really interesting about this is most of them said that sales job was a significant factor in their financial success. So the talents they learned from learning sales early on played a big factor in how rich they are.
Did they connect the dots? Like, why? Why a sales job?
I mean, I think because everything is sales, right? These people, probably many of them, started their own company. You often don't get to be a billionaire, self-made billionaire, without doing that. They had to sell different people on different ideas all the way through this. They didn't connect that. They just said, sales was important to my company or something, but the nitty-gritty wasn't really explained. But everyone I talked to thought, well, yes, because sales impacts everything. You start your own company, you're selling to everybody all the time, and especially with these people way high up, they really got to, maybe they had to get investors early on, stuff like that. But in all the cases, they said sales was a huge, huge reason that they feel financially successful right now.
I guess, too, you develop a thick skin. You know, maybe when you get told no, you don't take it personally. I mean, I've tried sales a couple of times, and as soon as I'm told no at 9:01 in the morning, like, the rest of my day is shot. Like, I can't recover after being told no once.
Oh, absolutely.
I thought, I'm failure. I'm a loser. I'm done.
You're completely right. And it is probably thick skin. Plus, you got to learn, like, at first, not everyone's just persuasive at first. And these people really had to learn, you know, different people, persuading different kinds of people. I mean, I think there's a lot of value in it. I was writing this story thinking, oh, well, that explains why I'm not a multimillionaire right there.
That was why you're $10,999,000 short of being asked to participate in the survey of people worth $11 million and more.
100%.
Yes. We're speaking with Katie Hill, editor at MarketWatch. She's written an interesting piece entitled "The Number One Job Billionaires and Multimillionaires Had Before They Became Filthy Rich." And turns out most of them had sales jobs. What else did we learn from this? Is it too late to go get a sales job and try to learn a new skill?
I think I asked every career expert I could, because I thought, I mean, this is fascinating. I don't know a ton of people with a lot of sales experience, but, you know, this is something to think about. They all said, no, it's not too late. I mean, maybe you're not going to go, you know, work at a Starbucks or something, but even if you volunteer for an organization, like raising funds for your, you know, favorite charity or something, and you do that on the side, that's all really good experience.
Thanks, Katie. Katie Hill, editor at MarketWatch, based in New York. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
Not many things scare me, kid. Vampires, werewolves, children, not one bit. But you know what does scare me? Downtime, inefficiency, scares the living daylights out of me. That's why I use Grainger. They're America's number one source for industrial supplies. Plus, they've got the inventory management solutions that keep us running. So we've got uptime, we've got efficiency, we've got productivity. When it comes to keeping your facility running, Grainger's got your back. Call or click Grainger.com to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
There's nothing small about your business. Your passion, your hours, your reputation, it's all huge. Your partnerships, even bigger. With Dell Small Business Technology Advisors, you'll get the tech, advice, and one-on-one partnership to help your business grow. Because with reliable Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, you can focus on what matters most, getting business done. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show, like us on Facebook, or send us an email, thismorning@compassmedianetworks.com.
Thanks for being with us. It is Monday, January 21. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka. Some of our top stories and headlines. Democrats reject Trump's proposal to reopen the government. Bitter cold settles in after a weekend winter storm for a good chunk of the country. At least 85 people are dead after an illegally tapped fuel line blew up in Mexico as people were stealing from it. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It'll be the Patriots and Rams in Super Bowl 53 in Atlanta. Serena into the quarters at the Australian Open. And can your employer require you to work in dangerous winter weather? That story in about 20 minutes. With heightened threats around the world and Russia's claim of a new invulnerable weapon, President Trump and Pentagon leaders have released their first sweeping review of U.S. missile defense systems in quite some time. The study, first commissioned in 2017 as part of the Trump administration's broader national security strategy, will serve as both a review of current U.S. missile defense systems and also a blueprint for how to confront new threats, including those posed by North Korea, Iran, and Russia. More from Ben Wolfgang, Pentagon correspondent at The Washington Times. Ben, what do we have?
Well, look, so I mean, the bottom line is the Pentagon, President Trump laid it out during a speech at the Defense Department. They put up this Defense Missile Review, which is a comprehensive review of all the U.S. missile defense systems. The first time that the U.S. had done this kind of wide sweeping review in almost a decade. And basically, they're looking at, are we protected at this point from any threats from North Korea, from Iran, from Russia, and from China? I'm sure you remember, Gordon, just a couple weeks ago, Vladimir Putin boasted that he has a new hypersonic missile that can evade any defense system anywhere in the world. So that certainly got people's attention here in the U.S. So this review is very timely in that regard. So they're They're looking at a variety of both traditional above-ground missile interceptors. The president called for 20 more of those to be placed in Alaska. And but sort of the cool thing, as you mentioned, is this idea of space-based sensors. This would probably go under the auspices of the Space Force that the president's been pushing now for the past few months. So this is still kind of very early in the discussion and the research phase. Nobody's exactly sure when this could get rolled out, how much it's going to cost, or what exactly it would look like. But theoretically, what you would have is satellites in space that are equipped with lasers and sensors that could, number one, detect missiles. And down the road, the idea is shoot them out of the air if anything were to be fired at the U.S.
All right. Well, there might not be a timeline, but I mean, realistically, how soon could something like this be up and running? Because it seems, as you suggested in the story, we might be embarking on an arms race.
Yeah, it certainly seems that we're embarking on arms, whether we want to be or not. I mean, the Defense Department says, look, we've had hypersonic technology for years. We've chosen not to weaponize it. China and Russia obviously have made a different choice and have chosen to weaponize it. So the people inside the Defense Department seem to think that this is going to be a couple of years. The impression I got from talking to folks and from the briefing we got from the missile experts inside the Pentagon is that this is probably something on the order of 2 to 3 years, at least for the research phase, to determine how much it's going to cost and how exactly it could be done. So I think you'd be looking at probably a time frame of maybe, say, 3 years, 5 years on a high end of the estimate before we could potentially see this stuff up and running.
We're speaking with Ben Wolfgang, Pentagon correspondent at the Washington Times. He's got a piece entitled Military Eyes Space-Based Layer of Sensors in New Missile Defense. Was it said that our current missile defense system is out of date or not
well,
good?
That's kind of the question that, frankly, nobody wants to come out and say that because, you know, even the president was like, look, our defenses are okay. They can protect against the threats that are out there, traditional ballistic missiles, for example, that, you know, we've been talking about for decades now. But there is a fear that we are not prepared for some of these cutting-edge weapons, particularly hypersonic weapons, which travel much faster than anything we've seen before and can kind of take a deviated route, not the traditional just, you know, an arc of a missile that's aiming at a target. These kind of zigzag through space, and so it's much harder to defend against them. So there are a lot of people inside the Defense Department and analysts outside who say, we might not at this point be able to defend against that, theoretically, if it were fired by Russia or China at a U.S. city. So, look, I mean, nobody from the president on down to the people in the Pentagon, nobody wants to, you know, cause a panic or alarm among the population. But there is a real fear that our current system is, if it's not out of date already, is going to be out of date pretty soon.
These hypersonic missiles you referenced, they zigzag through space instead of a traditional arc. How fast do they go?
Oh, man, they go, I don't have the figures right in front of you. I think it's something on the order of like 20 miles a minute or something to that effect. Like, it's these are the fastest missiles that we've seen. Look, I mean, Russia said they conducted a successful test of one of these just a couple of weeks ago, and Vladimir Putin was very proud to come out and say that. So we don't, at least as far as I know, we don't have those weapons. So, I mean, if you get into a nightmare scenario where there's some type of an armed conflict with Russia, which already has these, or with China, which is going to have them pretty soon, we could be in a difficult spot, and that's why the attention right now is focused on the defense.
Thanks, Ben. Ben Wolfgang, Pentagon correspondent at the Washington Times. 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Hey, glad you're with us. Welcome into Monday. The number of Americans 16 and older who hunt is down 18% from 2 decades ago, according to federal data. An older generation of hunters is trying to lure recruits to the sport by pitching it as a good way to ensure meat is local, sustainable, and probably organic. It's a story by Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhirter. Cam, what's going on?
Associations that promote hunting and the hunting industry are in a panic because people aren't hunting like they used to. Generations of people used to teach their children how to hunt and go out and look for deer, and people just aren't doing that anymore, and there's a whole host of reasons. Not the least of which is that America is not really a rural country anymore. Mm-hmm. So people aren't doing it. Also, there's things called video games where you can have instant gratification instead of sitting in a deer stand for 8 hours freezing. So, you know, hunting requires a lot of patience. It requires, then you have to actually kill something. and you have to gut it, and you have to drag it back to your car. I mean, it's a lot of work, and people would rather play video games than go to the store.
I can't even imagine. How do you begin to market hunting to millennials?
Well, that was the ingenious effort of several people, but one of the key people was a guy named Hank Forrester, who works for a group called the Quality Deer Management Association, based just outside of Athens, Georgia. And he was going to the Athens Farmers Market and noticed all these foodies and hipsters walking around sampling locally grown food and locally sourced food. And he thought, well, what's more local than going out and shooting a deer and bringing it back home? So he started, he asked to set up a table there with a friend, and they set up this table and started offering free samples of venison in various, he's a really good cook, and he's very good at cooking venison, so he would cook, sausages, chili, all kinds of things, and people loved it. And as they were eating these samples, he would say, well, by the way, would you like to learn how to hunt? And there are many Americans who wanted to learn how to hunt, younger Americans who, no one around them does it. So you don't just walk into the forest with a crossbow or a rifle. You need somebody to sort of show you what to do. And so he set up a program to do that called Field to Fork. And it's been doing quite well and attracting people who are not your traditional hunters. You know, the traditional hunter, tries to get the largest deer it can, and then, the guy stands next to it with his photo or gets a selfie with the animal he shot. That's not what's going on here. These are people who are very concerned about factory processed foods and wanting to eat locally sourced stuff, and they want to eat meat. So they feel that this is the most ethically reasonable choice.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhirter. He's written a piece about how some veteran hunters are trying to recruit millennials with the theme of hunters are the original conservationists. And another theme they use is harvest your own local meat. Have these guys been able to sway any of the younger folks?
Yeah, I mean, I went out with a bunch of hunters. We actually saw nothing except for some squirrels, but I did get to freeze my butt off for several hours in the deer stand.
Yeah.
But I was in the Georgia wilds. But the people, there's a lot of younger people who were getting into it. I mean, is this going to reverse a pretty steep decline in hunting? That remains to be seen. There would have to be a lot of people, a lot of hipsters would have to head into the forest to reverse that trend. But they're hopeful that it will bring younger people in who normally would never have considered it. And the people that I met with this group, Field to Fork, were very, very committed. I met a young woman who had lots of ethical quandaries about eating meat, but really wanted to eat meat and had determined that human beings were omnivores. So she started eating roadkill that she would find in the road, and then she decided, well, I'm going to learn how to hunt. And she was at the farmer's market and met these people. I'm surprised she ate roadkill, but she did.
Thanks, Cam. Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhirter. 12 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Glad you're with us. Welcome into Monday. 8 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning. Jennifer Koshenka is back with more of America's First News.
Gordon, a winter storm dumped up to 18 inches of snow across much of upstate New York and northern New England over the weekend, a prelude to an Arctic blast of cold air and icy winds across the Northeast. The highest snowfall totals were in inland Maine, which got nearly 2 feet of snow. Farther south, snow turned to sleet and freezing rain. This morning, the issue in many places is wind. Meteorologist Brian Hurley.
Wind advisories out are in effect because of the wind behind the system, and also wind chill advisories. As we look for the wind chills, they'll be around 10 below zero, maybe a little colder.
New York City got mainly rain, while Boston received anywhere from 1 to 5 inches of snow before the precipitation turned to rain and sleet. A massive explosion at an illegal pipeline tap in central Mexico has now killed at least 85 people and injured dozens more as forensic experts identify corpses at the site. The illegal tap and resulting blast occurred about 70 miles north of Mexico City on Friday. Videos show that before the explosion, hundreds of local residents had gathered gathered to fill plastic tanks from a geyser of fuel spouting from the pipeline while soldiers stood by watching. After two nail-biting conference title games that went into overtime, the teams for the Super Bowl are set. It'll be who else but the Patriots versus the Rams. In the AFC Championship, the Patriots survived a 37-31 shootout against MVP candidate Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. Victorious quarterback Tom Brady.
We knew it was going to take a lot. It obviously took into overtime. It took some great plays and great conversions. And just proud of us getting the job done.
In the NFC Championship, the Rams topped the Saints 26-23 on a 57-yard field goal by Greg Zuerlein in overtime. They're as much a part of New York City as the Empire State Building, those hot dog stands that line many streets. But are they safe and clean? The city is trying to assure eaters by giving food carts the kind of letter grades that restaurants get. The first batch of grades has already gone out to about two dozen of the city's more than 5,000 food carts and trucks. All of them will be graded within 2 years.
Mm. Some things I just don't want to know.
Yeah. Some things you just don't want to eat either.
It is my contention that if you put the proper amount of sauerkraut and mustard on one of those cart hot dogs, it doesn't matter. It just kind of cleans itself. Thanks, Jen. 6 minutes in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. When bad weather strikes, companies must make decisions on office closures, pay, leave, and safety. In inclement weather, are employers legally required to do anything to ensure a safe workplace? Here's a question. Can employers require you to come to work in inclement weather? A guy named Jonathan Taylor, an HR expert from the Society for Human Resource Management, says yes, but depending on the severity of the weather, it might not be a good idea. He says employers should consider safety risks like the potential for auto accidents or slips and falls. Even if a company is open, employees might not be able to get to work because roads are too hazardous for driving or schools are closed and children have to be cared for. In these cases, employees should contact managers to take time off, either unpaid or paid, using time or vacation time. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.